Does anybody know whose mascot this is? You're thinking the Syracuse Orangemen, but no. Oddly enough, this is the mascot for organ donation. I'm not kidding. Donate life. If you could see the cap, it says donate life. And there has been a significant push to get more people registered to donate organs. And one of the techniques is to make it really nice by having its own mascot. Her name is Dottie. Dottie the donor dot. Okay. It seems to have been successful in some ways. In Montana, 84% of potential donors are registered as donors. In Vermont, only 18% are. So if you're from those states, you see where you fit. Wisconsin, 58%. So Dottie has more work to do, I guess. Obviously, this isn't a normal preaching session. I want to do a mini bioethics seminar and talk about organ donation in a couple of different aspects. First of all, I want to talk about whether the concept is ethical. Is it ethical for you to donate your organs? And secondly, I want to talk about the practice of that. If in fact, it is ethical to donate your organs to someone who needs that, and I suspect that most of you know someone who has received a kidney, received a heart, and are living today because someone donated an organ. But is it ethical, the practice, the way they go about doing it? And I want to talk a little bit about that. You might say, why should I care? I'll be dead. Well, here's maybe why. Maybe you should think about it now rather than later. This is an older Wisconsin driver's license, and you see in the top right corner a little dot, which is where Dottie the mascot comes from. Okay? That little dot means that you have registered in the state of Wisconsin to be an organ donor. And there are similar things like this in pretty much every state and territory to indicate ahead of time that you're willing to be an organ donor. Here's a more recent license in Wisconsin. In the bottom right corner now, you have a little bit smaller dot, but the dot is still there. When you go get your driver's license, you will probably be asked, do you want to be an organ donor? And given the vast amounts of information they give you at that time, you have to make a choice, yes or no. I want to talk about that so that you have some information when you go and make that choice. If you're in Wisconsin and you took driver's training after 2000, you probably have a half hour of training that is extremely pro-organ donation, and if you don't do it, you're a bad person. Okay? But nonetheless, there is some exposure, but I want to talk about this from a biblical perspective. Should we do this or not? Let's talk about the concept of donating organs. Is it ethical or not? Let me give you several arguments that would be in favor of donating your organs. Now, you understand what I mean. When you die, they open you up, they take your heart, they fly that heart somewhere and put it in somebody else, and that person lives with your organ. Okay, that's what we're talking about. First of all, it's pro-life. We claim to be pro-life. We claim to respect life and want to heal. Jesus was the master healer, physically healing people. So it seems as if it were pro-life, we would be in favor of something that preserves life. And donating your organ after you're dead preserves someone else's life. So it is pro-life. Now understand, these are principles. There was no such thing as organ donation when the Bible was written. You're not going to have a direct verse. The closest we get is Adam donated a rib so that he could have a wife. Okay? But that's a slightly different thing. We don't have people doing miracles, creating a human being today with one of your ribs. Okay? Nonetheless, there's a hint of it at least there. Okay? So these principles seem to be, to me, in favor of it. So it's pro-life. It's good stewardship. We have been instructed by God to care for the things that have been placed in our control, under our authority. We care for finances that God entrusts to us. We care for possessions like cars and houses. In fact, we make a plan for what to do with our cars and houses and money after we die. If you knew someone who had a beautiful house and they said, okay, I'm died, burn the house, you'd say, well, what a waste. Well, I realize that a house is not an organ. But a lot of times we take good care of our bodies because we are good stewards of our bodies, and we die, it returns to dust. And we could make a plan to say, I want my heart to go to someone so that they can have life. And that's the idea of planning intentionally, if that's what you want to do. If in fact you view organs and tissues as a resource that God has entrusted to you, it seems like it would make sense that you would plan for the care of those things, those organs, tissues, after you die. It seems to me that it would be good stewardship. But even beyond that, it demonstrates love for others. Let me read a couple of verses. 1 John 3:16-17. Hereby perceive we the love of God, because he laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoso has this world's goods and sees his brother have need and shuts up his bowels of compassion from him, how dwells the love of God in him? Now, I understand they're talking about food and clothing and housing in this particular context, but you have a heart that someone needs, and you're going to say, fine, they're not going to have it. It's going to rot to dust with me in the grave. In some ways, is that a demonstration of love? I can tell you how the world views this. If you tell them, no, I don't want to do it in my organs, they'll look at you like, how could you be so selfish? They don't interpret it as love. In James chapter 2, verse 8, if you fulfill the royal law according to the scriptures, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, you do well. If a brother or sister be naked or destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace and be warmed and filled, notwithstanding you give them not those things which are needful to the body, what does it profit? That doesn't demonstrate a living faith in James chapter 2. So there is some notion that we demonstrate love for others by trying to help them recover from an illness, continue living after we no longer need the organs. It does good for others. Galatians 6, 9, and 10, and let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. And we have, therefore, as we therefore have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. Now, again, I understand doing good to others is not directly referring to donating organs to others. That's something that you do for others while you're still alive. But there's a principle of doing good to others, which I think donating an organ would be doing good for someone else. So it does good for others. It shines our testimony to the lost. They see what we do. Matthew 5:16, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. Titus chapter 1 and verse 16, talking about false teachers on the island of Crete, says, they profess that they know God, but in works they deny him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every good work a reprobate. There is some sense in which if we refuse to do a good work, and if you identify organ donation as a good work, you deny the faith in some ways. Titus 3:8, the opposite of it. This is a faithful saying, and these things that I will that thou affirm constantly, that they which have believed in God might be careful to maintain good works. These things are good and profitable unto men. So there seems to be some reasons that you could say are pro-donating your organs. There also may be some arguments against it. And I'm not trying to tell you what you should believe. These are the things that make sense to me. Do research on your own if you're not satisfied with what I'm saying, please. It desecrates the body after death. You die, they remove upwards of over 25 different organs and tissues. We'll talk about in a minute. Does that desecrate the body? Is that a reason not to donate your organs? Well, if you think about it, first of all, if you die and without massive amounts of chemicals that to embalm you, you return to dust. What does that do to the body? It seems like that's worse than taking an organ out. Okay? We are created in the image of God. And because we're created in the image of God, murder is wrong. Taking an organ out of a person after they're dead is not murder. Okay, so I don't think that you are intentionally destroying the body to mar the image of God. We could say that, you know, our temples are the body of God, and that's why we are the temple of the Holy Spirit, and that's why we care for them. Right. What happens when you die? Your tent is no longer the temple of the Holy Spirit. So I don't think the idea of desecrating the body after death, if you're doing this for a good, loving purpose, is a reason not to donate organs. Second possible reasons, believers need their whole body for the resurrection. This is an argument that has been made by some. But it really doesn't pass the common sense test. Okay? This would mean that anybody with dentures is in trouble. Look, you know, I don't have my original teeth. I can't be resurrected. The brave soldier who had his leg disintegrated by an IED. Can he be resurrected? The guy that was buried at sea and the fish ate him. Can he be resurrected? Yeah, absolutely. We don't need every single body part for God to resurrect us. He's going to revolutionize us. He's going to regenerate us and give us a new body, a resurrected body that will fix all the problems that we have. It certainly wasn't a problem for Adam. When he lost a rib, he seemed to be fine in the resurrection. Okay, so I don't think this is a valid reason to say that we should oppose organ donation. The need for anti-rejection drugs means that it's against God's plan. Generally, if you receive an organ, that has a slightly different DNA than yours, and your body will naturally attack that organ, so they give you these anti-rejection drugs, so that your body can live with that seemingly foreign object. So it's really unnatural. You shouldn't do it. Well, every medication that you take has side effects in a similar way. But if the purpose is good, ask the question, is it better to live having to take anti-rejection drugs, or is it better to die? Which does more damage to the body? Death does. I don't think the notion that you have to take anti-rejection drugs is a valid reason to say I shouldn't donate organs. Let me go back. It's not right for people to make so much money on my organs. You can't sell them. And technically nobody else sells them. However, here's some statistics from 2011. If you are going to receive a heart, you are going to have to pay a group that got the organ out of someone $80,000 just to get that organ. Now, you're not buying the organ. At least that's what they say. You're paying for the procurement, the getting of the organ. Because somebody had to go and take the organ out of the dead person and fly it to where you are and hand it off to you, and that was worth $80,000 in 2011. Intestines, $78,500. Kidney, $67,000. Liver, $71,000. A double lung, $90,000. Pancreas, $65,000. See how much you're worth? You had all that up? Never mind. You know what? This might be right. Maybe this is unethical that they're charging these kinds of fees to procure an organ for you to have. But that doesn't make the practice, the concept itself wrong. That's part of the practice that we need to think about. And it would be illegal for you to sell them. All right, so that's the concept. I think the concept is a good thing. I think it's ethical for you to donate organs after you're dead. But what about the practice of it? There are a number of different things. First, we need to distinguish between living and dead donation. You can donate a kidney while you're still alive. I wouldn't recommend donating two kidneys. Unless, of course, God created you with three. Which I know of a case where someone donated a kidney and they still had two left. Very unusual. You can donate part of your liver, a lobe of your lung, bone marrow while you're still alive. You don't give up your whole liver, your whole lungs, all of your lungs until you're dead. Or your heart, or your pancreas, or your intestines, or your skin, or your corneas. Okay? Those are things that are procured from you after you die. Okay, so I'm talking this morning mostly about the dead donor side of things. There is a dead donor rule that is practiced in most countries. And it says this: it is unethical to cause death by harvesting organs. Although it's been alleged very recently that ISIS has been harvesting organs out of people, causing their deaths to fund their battles. And it's also alleged that they have killed upwards of a dozen different doctors who refuse to do it. Those 12 doctors said it's unethical to cause death by procuring an organ out of a person. Second half of it, and it's unethical for organ procurement to precede death. Before someone's dead, go take their heart. In a sense, you're causing death. Although, there has been a recent movement that if doctors determine that you're going to die within maybe a week, there are some who say, well, they're not going to need their kidneys. Let's go take their two kidneys while they're still alive because they're probably going to die anyway. And that is an ethical debate that's going on in the medical community today. At what point, if they can take your kidneys before you die, they're much healthier and have better success transplanting them into somebody else. Okay? So what is the urgency to declare death? Now, there's several factors. Healthy organs for transplant. They need to get your organs before they decay, before they die, before they're untransplantable. So the quicker they can declare you dead, the quicker they can get your organs. There's a perpetual shortage of organs. There are always more people on the waiting list than there are available organs. It's always going to be an issue until we further develop this whole idea of 3D printing of organs. You ever heard of a 3D printer? They have already successfully used human cells to 3D print a trachea and implant it in someone, and that person is living successfully with a 3D printed trachea. They haven't progressed that way to yet for hearts and livers and lungs, but if they do, then this will be a moot discussion. It won't make any difference at all. Okay? But until that time, there's a desire to get your organs. Procurement teams are notified before you're dead. You go to a hospital, and there are doctors who are caring for you, and alongside of them, there's a procurement team, usually from procurement groups. And when you look like you might be dying soon or a traumatic accident, the doctors call the procurement team. The procurement team comes, and they talk to the family and say, will you donate their organs? You can help upwards of 50 people improve their lives or maybe save 8 lives just by donating organs. Will you do it? And then the procurement team begins as soon as possible. As soon as someone's declared dead, they start taking organs so that they can get them in the healthiest possible condition to the people that need them. What about procurement issues? We're talking about the practice of this, there are several issues that come up. Procurement issues, that is, how do you get organs? Distribution issues, how do you decide who gets the one that you got? Financial issues. I jotted down about 25 different practice kinds of issues that are being discussed today, like should you opt in or opt out? In America, unless you opt into being an organ donor, they assume you're not one. In some countries, unless you opt out, you say, no, I don't want to be one, they assume you are. And that's an issue. Which way should it be? Should prisoners be forced to donate organs? What about welfare recipients? Let me quote you from T. Anthony Zelinsky. This was when he was a Milwaukee County Board Supervisor. Now he's the Milwaukee County Alderman for the 14th District. He says about welfare recipients being required to donate organs. This is what he said. If they can't help society when they're alive, maybe they can help while they're help it while they're dead. That's an ethical discussion that you need to have, I guess. Should homosexuals be allowed to donate organs? This is not my issue. This is what's being discussed in the medical community. And I think at this point they can donate corneas and that's it. Should doctors be required to inform the procurement group? Should people that are declared dead be kept alive so their organs are better? Should you take organs from a pregnant woman? Those are procurement kinds of issues that you talk about. What about distribution? Who decides who gets the organ? Does the donor have a say in who gets the organ? What criteria are used to decide? Real case, a father who has two children with the same ailment and they both need a kidney transplant, he's a match for both of them. But he can only donate to one. Which one does he decide? Which one does he choose? Should the recipient know who the donor is? Should children under 12 be allowed to have an adult organ? There was a court case about that not too long ago. Should a judge change a doctor's decision? Those are distribution issues. What about financial issues? Should you be able to sell your organs? Should your family be allowed to sell them? Should your family be allowed to be compensated because you were willing to give? Is $1.2 million an ethical amount of money to spend on a transplant for 10 more years of life? Should the government fund UNIS, the United Network for Organ Sharing, which oversees all the distribution of organs? Should there be a criminal or civil penalty for abusing a new organ when somebody else would have gotten it and didn't do that? Should the recipient be allowed to pay for the living donor's expenses? There are all sorts of financial issues like that. I want to focus on one specific issue in the time I have left, and that is, when is someone dead? I'm not talking about a theological definition of death. I'm talking about a biological definition of death. And let me say that this is... for a long time been an issue. Edgar Allan Poe, in his short story, The Premature Burial, in 1844, said there are some issues that are so horrendous that they're not good for fiction. And he wrote some pretty weird things. Okay? But not this one. People being buried alive. Now, that's not the issue we're talking about this morning, but what about a person whose organs are harvested while he's still alive? Because a doctor mistakenly said he was dead. Hey, that's what I want to think about. Let me go through a little bit of the history of this. The only certain proof of death is the putrefaction of or decay of the human body. You want to make sure someone's really dead? Wait until they start stinking. Isn't that what Martha said in John 11:39 to Jesus? Jesus says, go open Lazarus' tomb. And Martha says, who, are you sure about that, Lord? By this time, he stinks. Because you can smell death. When the cells start to self-destruct and die, it gives off a particular aroma. There's no doubt that that person is dead. But if you want the organs, it's too late to get them at that point. You can't wait that long for proof of death, or you can't transplant the organs because the organs are decaying. And that creates the issue. Decay begins shortly after the blood ceases to carry oxygen to the body. And different cells live different amounts of time. Your brain cells, 3 minutes to 10 minutes, gone. But you can reattach an arm after maybe 6 hours. Those cells stay alive. Skin, bone, and tendon, some say 8 to 12 hours those cells stay alive before, without oxygen, before they die. So there are different lengths of time that, you know, you might be dead, but your bones stay alive for 12 hours. So the medical definition of death is somewhat vague, as Poe said. Until the 20th century, death was connected with the cessation of breathing, failure of the heart, which makes sense because in Genesis it talks about the breath of life being breathed into us by God. In the rest of Scripture, it talks about life is in the blood. So the connection of breathing and heart beating, even biblically, is connected with life and therefore death. Now we can restart your heart. We can get you breathing again. So when in the past you were dead and you didn't start breathing, your heart didn't beat again, now we can do it for you even. Okay, 1953, James Gibbons created this heart-lung machine, a newer model of it, still used today. This can circulate your blood. It can oxygenate your blood. It can keep your body temperature normal. It can, in a sense, keep you alive, even though your heart isn't beating and you're not breathing on your own. So 100 years ago, you'd be dead. Today, you're being kept alive, and many, many people, after being on this kind of a machine for a while, recover and return to normal life. So is it legitimate to say when your heart stops and when you stop breathing, you're biologically dead? Probably not. This was, though, what the primary source of organs at the beginning of the organ procurement transplant movement. Someone's heart stopped, they stopped breathing, you took their organs. Unfortunately, you didn't get enough organs from that. This protocol all but disappeared with the development of brain death criteria, which have better outcomes. If you don't wait for the heart to stop, which stops the oxygen from flowing, you can get better organs for transplant. So let's create a new criteria called brain death. And in 1968, there were a group of doctors who wrote an article called A Definition of Irreversible Coma. You know what their goals were? Number one, to relieve suffering of those who are resuscitated but have irreversible brain damage. So you're sitting in a coma, but your heart's still beating, but your brain is irreversibly dead. Why are we keeping you alive on a machine? Actually, you don't need a machine. Your heart's still beating, but you're brain dead, so you're dead. Let's take your organs. Notice the second reason for them doing this study, promoting this. To redefine death so that more organs can be obtained for transplant. These doctors want you dead as soon as possible so that they can take your organs while they're healthier. I'm not making this up. I'll show you the article. That's exactly what it says. That led to the Uniform Determination of Death Act, 1980. And that basically says you're dead if there's an irreversible cessation of circulatory respiratory functions. If you stop breathing, your heart stops, and that's irreversible, you're dead. Or if there's irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem, that person is dead, either one. And if they declare you dead by either one of these means, they can take your organs. Obviously, this is not your brain, but it's a picture of a brain. And you'll notice the brain stem is at the very, very bottom, and that controls things like your breathing, your heartbeat, reflexes, your eyes dilating. So technically, you could have that part of your brain die, but still be aware of things going on around you. Because the top part of your brain, recognition, comprehension, still works. Supposedly, you're supposed to have all parts of your brain dead to be legally brain dead. Okay, so you would think that they'd put one of these skull caps on you. Here's one with a few sensors, and here's one with more sensors. And they see if there's any electrical activity in your brain. Now, you would think that's how they declare you brain dead, right? They see if there's any electrical activity in your brain, and if there's not, you're dead. You're a complete brain. That is not how they determine whether you're brain dead in the hospital. Okay, the American Academy of Neurology put out a standard protocol for how you determine someone's brain dead. One, you have to be in a coma. And by coma, they're talking about an irreversible or lacks all evidence of responsiveness not caused by imitators like drugs. You can have a drug overdose and appear to be dead. Hypothermia, you could appear to be dead. If you're paralyzed, you could appear to be dead because there are no reflexes. There are a number of imitators of this, but if you're in a coma, there's no responses, and it's not one of these imitators, that's one thing that they look for. Okay, they're in a coma, they might be dead. Okay, let's go to the second. Absence of brainstem reflexes. There's about six things they do, and let me tell you what they do. Number one, they shine a light in your eyes. And if your pupils don't dilate and restrict, that's an indication that you're dead because there's no reflex there. Number two, they move your head side to side and see if your eyes move. You know, technically, when you move your head, your eyes will stay where they were. But if your eyes stay the same, they say you're probably dead. No brain function there at all. Number three, they poke you in the eye. They take a Q-tip and they poke you in the eye and see if there's any movement in your eyelid. Because if somebody pokes you in your eye, your normal reflex is to close your eye. Number four, they pinch you and watch for a response. You know, they call it obnoxious stimuli. And it is, if somebody pinches you and it hurts, you respond. But if there's no response, it must mean your brain is dead. Number five, they shove a stick or a suction tube down the back of your throat to see if you gag. And if you don't, you're probably dead. Number six, they shoot cold water in your ear and see if you shiver. Not making it up, that's what they do. Okay? This is in the American Academy of Neurology protocols. How long would that take? Not very long. That's how they determine if you're brain dead. Okay, one last thing, the apnea test. They oxygenate your blood to 100% on the machine, and then they shut the machine off so it doesn't breathe for you. And when the oxygen level in your blood gets down a certain level and the carbon dioxide level goes up, the natural human response is to gasp for air. So if the oxygen goes down, the carbon dioxide goes up, and there's no gasping for air, you're probably dead. That's it. You're dead. They declared you dead. Let me just go forward to this. In adults, ancillary tests are not needed for clinical diagnosis of brain death and cannot replace a neurological exam. This is the American Academy of Neurology again, says they don't need to put the cap on you and see if there's electrical activity. That's rare. If you have a neck injury and they can't move your head side to side, they might do this. Or if there's some other question from the three things, the neurological exam, they might do this. But no, they don't have to. It's they're recommending that you don't need to. When the full clinical... So is that done in hospitals locally? This is a statement directly from the protocols of a local hospital, not Watertown, but a local hospital in Wisconsin. This is what they do. This is what they say, January 2015 protocols. When the full clinical examination, including both assessment of brainstem reflexes, apnea test, is conclusively performed, no additional testing is required to determine brain death. Okay? And they even say a repeated examination at a later time by a different physician is not required. Most times you have a physician that does the tests. You wait 24 hours, 12 hours, 6 hours, 2 days, and you do the test again, and that proves it's irreversible. This local hospital in Wisconsin, one time is enough. You don't need a second exam. How reliable is this method? Let me quickly give you some statements. The UDDA direct principles define the essential elements needed to determine brain death. However, because of the deficiencies in the evidence base, clinicians must exercise considerable judgment when applying the criteria. Despite publication of the practice parameters, considerable variation remains. There is insufficient evidence to determine the minimally acceptable observation period to ensure neurological functions have ceased irreversibly. Complex spontaneous motor movements, reflexes, and false positives gasping for air do occur in brain-dead patients. So they could mistake an accidental one for a real one, or a real one for an accidental one. But yet, they say, there has never been a single case reported of a physician following these requirements and declaring someone brain-dead only to turn out to be wrong. Let me interpret what they just said. When we're right, we're never wrong. Or, in a different way, we've never had anybody who had his organs harvested who came back to life. I think that's what they're saying there. let me quickly mention the Pittsburgh Protocol. Because this didn't produce enough organs, the Pittsburgh Protocol in 1993 reintroduced, basically, forget brain death, now it's heart and lung death again. We're going back to heart and lung death. So you could have a brain that has activity, reflexes, but your heart and lungs stop, that's it. So it has to be irreversible cardiac and pulmonary death. So how long does it take to determine irreversible cardiac and breathing times? 1.5 minutes. Some suggest up to 5 minutes, but if you go much past 5 minutes, you're damaging organs and they can't use them anyway. You want absolute proof? Wait 30 minutes or an hour or 12 hours. But then you can't transplant organs. I'm not going to say much more about the Pittsburgh Protocol. The question is this. Do you want that dot? Okay, let me mention some questions. Here's the Wisconsin state law, just so you have it. That's the webpage. Here's what it says. Having your name included in the Wisconsin donor registry means that you have authorized the gift of your organs, tissues, and eyes upon death. When you say yes at the DMV, this is what you're saying. You're authorizing them to take your heart. Once you register as a donor, you have made a record of an anatomical gift in accordance with Wisconsin state law. And if you're at least 18 years old, your decision may not be overridden by your family or any other person. Your family can't come and say you're not dead. Don't stop. Wait. Don't take the organs. They're not dead yet. They'll say to you, hey, the doctor declared them dead. They declared as a donor. You can't do anything about it. So the question really is, who do you want to decide when you're dead? The doctor who's getting refresher from the procurement team and won't let you go too long because that'll damage organs? Or your family or your spouse or someone with medical power of attorney? You need to think about that and come to some decisions on your own. Secondly, what would the motive of that person be? What's the doctor's motive for declaring you dead? What would your spouse's motive be for declaring you dead? Hopefully not life insurance. Number three, is that person able to make a decision? This is not an easy thing to consider. Maybe your parents would struggle emotionally saying, yes, take the organs. 50% of people who are asked after a family member's death say no. Maybe you don't want to put that pressure on your parents or your spouse to make that decision because it would be just too emotionally difficult for them to make a decision like that, so you're going to leave it in the hands of the doctor. I'm not telling you what way to go. I'm just saying think about this and make a decision. And lastly, make your own intentional decisions about these issues and clearly communicate them to your family, so they have an idea what your wishes are with regard to this issue. I'm out of time. So let's have a word of prayer and we'll be dismissed. Father, we're grateful that you have given us a life. Thank you that we are able to discuss issues like this biblically. Just pray that we would be able to apply biblical principles to this issue, make good choices, and think about it so that we make a biblical informed decision on organ donation, and not just a spontaneous at the DMV type decision. I pray that we would function in this area in a way that would bring you glory, so that people might see our works and glorify our Father who is in heaven. I ask this in Christ's name. Amen.